Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Everyone knows the proverbial morning person who wakens with little or no external prompting. Don't you hate them? For the rest of us, it can take a little extra push or light or sound or vibration to oust us from our slumbers. Joining us now to talk about our options on that score is Alan Henry. He writes for lifehacker.com and joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Well, thanks for having me.
So are you easy to wake up or not?
Not at all. Okay. Not remotely.
What do you use then?
I use my phone as my alarm clock because it's usually the first thing I have to look at in the morning anyway. I have to get up and look at my email and everything. Oddly enough, for being not a morning person, I am the morning person at Lifehacker. So,
well, just for the exact reason you use your smartphone is why I don't use mine, but I don't want to look at things right when I wake up. Question for our listeners, what gadget or app do you use to wake up in the morning? Give us a call and tell us what you use, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alan Henry, you did a survey a few years back about what people do use. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that there's a very much kind of a division between a lot of our readers. Many of them have very old-style traditional alarm clocks that they've had for years or were passed down to them. You know, you just plug them into the wall. They have a standard little LCD display, you know, red numbers that shine at you in the dark. And usually those ones made by Sony and General Electric, they last forever, so they've never had a need to replace them. On the other hand, there are more and more people who are starting to use their smartphones as their alarms because they're attached to us all the time anyway. So then there's a burgeoning market of apps, both free and paid, for virtually every smartphone platform that will, at the very least, wake you up in the morning. A lot of them add other features that make sure you get out of bed as opposed to just reach over and hit snooze and go back to sleep.
Is there much of a business in alarm clocks, or is it, I mean, it's one of those things like umbrellas, right? You need them. Mm-hmm. You always need them. They're always for sale somewhere. But is there much innovation?
I think so, to a certain extent. I think that there are a lot of us who, our alarm clock is a functional part of our lives. So when it goes off, we hit the snooze button or we turn it off and we get out of bed. For a lot of people, especially people who want to sleep better or already have sleep disorders, they're looking for alarm clocks that can wake them up more smoothly or help them wake up in a natural way. And we stumbled on a number of alarm clocks like the Philips wake-up light that, in a completely dark room, starting maybe 15 minutes before you are supposed to be out of bed, it'll start bringing the lights up very, very gently to try and simulate natural sunlight coming through your window. That way you can kind of get that slow drifting up out of sleep state instead of a loud buzzing that's going to jar you awake. We've seen a number of those. We've seen some other products as well, like the sadly now discontinued Sony Dash and the Chumby, which are more kind of internet tablets that live next to your bed. They show you the weather, they give you news headlines and things like that, that they're the first things you see when you wake up in the morning. I think there's a market for those as well, even though those two particular products have started to go by the wayside.
Why did they go by the wayside anyways? Do you know?
I think in this case, one, they're unitaskers. People are looking for a product. If they're going to spend hundreds of dollars on something a tablet, yeah, they want something that's going to, you know, I want to take it with me. I want to take it to work. I want it to be more useful than this thing that sits next to my bed.
Gotcha. The tablets came out and Chumby went away.
Exactly.
A caller, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about alarm clocks. What kind of alarm clock do you use? We did have a caller call in and say they didn't want to be on the air, but they said they use NPR for wake up. Well, of course you use NPR for wake up, but what's the device that you use to listen to NPR for your wake up? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I will tell you, Alan Henry, about my nightmare of an alarm clock that I actually lived with for a couple years, thinking, well, it, you know, I, what do you do with an alarm clock unless it breaks, right? And it was that Moshi interactive talking alarm. I wanted to kill that thing.
Oh, no.
It was horrible.
Oh, that's a shame. I've heard good things about that one. I haven't tried it myself, but
well, it's really bright for one thing.
Yeah.
You either are brightening up your entire room or you can't see it at all. You know, you either turn it on or turn it off the light, but that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I didn't know how to use it.
No, that's a problem with a lot of these products. You know, they're so bright that they keep you from sleeping. I mean, the Moshi's kind of catch is supposed to be that you're supposed to be able to talk to it, but I have certainly seen a number of these alarm clocks that are so bright you can't sleep, even if you have a curtain shut.
Yeah, it was terrible. And yeah, all right, you can talk to Moshi, but see, I'm not really good with Siri either. So I get it's probably more about me and not about Moshi. Another product that you like is Neverlate.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
The Neverlate Executive Alarm Clock, and let's call itself Executive. It's a small, it's maybe just a little bigger than the palm of your hand, and it has individual alarms for every day of the week. So if you have to get up at different times of the day, you can program those alarms differently and never have to touch it again. It's small enough to travel with you, and it will play the radio. You know, you can tell it to wake you up on Monday mornings to NPR, or you can tell it to wake you up on Tuesday mornings to, your iPod or your music player that's connected to it. It's customizable in that regard. And the beauty of it is that it will run forever. It's got an internal battery, and you can plug it into the wall. And if you need to travel, you can take it.
Debbie in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. What's your method?
I have an app called Living Earth, and it's a beautiful picture of the Earth, and it has a lot of weather information, and it's on my iPhone 5. And I have it set to play Yo-Yo Ma playing Nostalgia from Cinema Paradiso. So if you want to have a song stuck in your head all day, that's a great song. And it's very calming when I wake up.
So you like to be, you wake up relatively easily then?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'm already awake when it goes off, but I still want to hear it play. So.
Truth be told, I acted as if I have a hard time getting up in the morning, but I'm exactly the same way, Debbie. So, well, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you, Debbie. Living Earth, there are, how many apps are there now out there for the smartphones?
Oh my goodness, there's more than I can possibly count. That's including the fact that most phones already have one built in. You don't have to download anything.
Okay.
But the ones that are available generally try to add on extra features. You know, some of them will make you do math problems before the alarm will go off. And it's funny, it's hilarious, but at the same time, if you're the type who just hits snooze and you'll forget that, and you'll hit snooze over and over again, and then suddenly you're late, it's brilliant because you have to solve times tables and things before you can get out of bed, turn it off, and then go get ready for work. And ideally, you know, by the time you've done math, you're not in the mood to go back to sleep.
All right, so while you're trying to solve these problems, is it still ringing or buzzing or whatever it does?
Absolutely.
Oh, jeez. Okay, that's stressing me out just thinking about it. Joyce in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Joyce. Hello, Joyce. Oops, I don't know what happened to Joyce. Maybe our screener can check with Joyce and see where she is. We have an email from Celine who writes, I wake up to 89.7 on my old-fashioned alarm clock radio, though I am one of these annoying morning people who wakes up 5 minutes prior to the alarm at 4:45 every morning. Celine, I'm with you on that. 89.7, of course, is our radio station, 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for that. An email from a listener. For those who believe there is a risk from cell phone radiation, there is an interesting book related to today's topic. It's called Zapped, Why Your Cell Phone Shouldn't Be Your Alarm Clock and 1,268 Ways to Outsmart the Hazards of Electronic Pollution. It's in paperback. Okay. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to tell us how you wake up in the morning. So tell us some more options about really heavy sleepers who dread getting up. The Sonic Boom alarm clock?
Yes, the Sonic Boom alarm clock. It's a clock. It's on the side of your bed, but it also has kind of a little pod that connects to it. And when your alarm goes off, you get the lights and the sound, but this pod is supposed to go under your pillow or just on the side of the bed, and it starts vibrating like crazy. And the sonic boom alarm clock is particularly named that way because it vibrates really violently and the alarm is really loud. So you have no chance of sleeping through that. So it actually shakes you awake and it makes all of this noise.
I already suffer from that phantom, cell phone vibration issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely. I think everybody's been there.
I don't need the phantom wake up call vibration too. The clocky, which rolls off the bed and makes you get up to fetch it.
It's fun. I had this one for a little while until once I'm up, so it's not too difficult to get me to stay awake. But the clocky is the simple, the small, it's a tiny little alarm clock, but it has these two big wheels on the side. And when it goes off, it rolls off your nightstand and it takes a random pattern around your room. So you have to get out of bed. It's blaring the whole time. And you have to get out of bed and chase it. When you catch it, you can turn the alarm off.
And it doesn't break?
No. It's the wheels are big and they're rubberized. So it'll roll underneath your furniture. It's small, too.
Uh-huh.
So it'll roll under the bed or under the bureau, or it'll roll out of your bedroom, and you have to catch it to turn it off. And it's loud. It's intense for someone who really, really will just roll over and go back to sleep, even if their alarm breaks.
I'm thinking Christmas gifts. If they could just attach a vacuum to it, I think we would be doing very, very well. Okay, Joyce from Columbus, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Joyce. Tell us your strategy.
Hi. Well, I'm one of those fortunate people that doesn't have to get up in the morning. And we just moved to a senior living place. And we're on the sixth floor. And the whole side of our bedroom is windows. We have no window coverings, and we don't expect to get any. And I get up when the sun comes out.
Oh, boo you.
And you know what? If it doesn't come out, I'm still in bed.
Oh, man. That sounds so wonderful. Joyce, I am jealous. You have a wonder. Are you out of bed yet?
I am.
Okay.
Well, I have a dog, and he's adjusting also to that. So eventually we have to get out of bed.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
thanks, Joyce, for the
day.
Call. Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Christina in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question. My daughter uses an app that she downloads, I think, from her on her iPhone. I'm sure it's on other platforms, too, that actually measures how many times she wakes up at night. She just puts the phone on her pillow. And the interesting part of it, and I just was wondering if your guest could comment on that, is that when you set it up to wake up in the morning, it actually measures when you are coming out of REM, and it wakes you up at the right time. If your alarm goes at 7, but you are not coming out of REM until 7:10, it waits until that time to wake you up. And I was just wondering if those really actually work and how they work.
Alan Henry?
Oh, yes. I'm familiar with a number of those kinds of apps. Sleep time for alarm clocks is one for the Android platform. There's a sleep cycle, which I think is for both Android and iPhone. They're great. And if you're the type of person who wants to track your sleep and you are worried about like sleep conditions like sleep apnea and you want to have an idea how often you wake during the night or when the best time for you to get up really is based on the way you go to bed and how long your sleep cycles are, they're great. They're great apps. You can just put them on the bed next to you, which may or may not be great if you're particularly a tosser turner, so the bed or your phone may fall off the bed. But a lot of them, they will use the phone's accelerometer to tell when you're restless over the course of the night and when you're sleeping soundly. And then based on its own kind of guess as far as how long the average human sleep cycle is, it'll start to wake you up with, you know, silent or a vibrating alarm or quiet music that gets progressively louder maybe 15 or 20 minutes before your sleep cycle kind of peaks and you're at that point where you're most susceptible to wake up naturally and comfortably as opposed to being jarred awake.
That's interesting. Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Beth. Got to turn down your radio. Okay. Let's quick squeeze in Judy. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So I wake up to those one of those lovely Panasonics that last forever with the big red letters, big red numbers, excuse me.
You write about those, don't you, Alan?
Absolutely.
Well, he's right. They last forever. I had one that lasted so long. The only reason I had to get another one is because last time I moved, it disappeared in the move, and I was disappointed that I had to go out and buy another one. But it was kind of a harsh reality because I like to know what time it is when I wake up in the middle of the night. So it has to be lit, mm-hmm. And my eyesight, my middle-aged eyesight is going, so it has to be big for me to see it. So I felt like my parents, you know, because of it. But it is, I used to wake up very easily, and now I wake up very difficultly. You know, I just don't like, to be honest, to wake up to news or noise of music. So I'm probably going to have to look for one of those that can wake me more gently. So even though it's hard for me to wake up, I don't want something loud to blast me awake. I want something calm and soothing that's going to wake me up in a good mood rather than put me in a bad mood.
Well, it sounds like that one you just talked about, Alan, might be the trick for her.
For the sleep cycle?
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be. I'm curious how I could possibly know. I just was reading a lot about sleep cycles because my toddlers are having trouble, and I don't think you're in REM as the last cycle of the adult sleep cycle, but maybe if it knows where you are, which I find surprising, then maybe it can personally tune to waken you up. But adults don't get into another cycle of REM until unless they can sleep in a little bit later. Toddlers do REM right before the early morning. So that's interesting. I'd be interested to check that one out. So,
all right.
Anyway, the old-fashioned Panasonic, big red numbers.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thanks for your show.
And Alan Henry, writer for lifehacker.com, thanks for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. It's Alan Henry. He's a writer for lifehacker.com. Coming up, we're going to talk about your dog and prospects of getting the dog to walk itself. Not really. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Remember Lassie? Or to be more accurate, remember all the lassies that played the part of the improbably smart and well-trained dog that entertained the public for years on television? Lassie was big on search and rescue, but humans have been working to harness the superior senses of the canine for thousands of years, from hunting, retrieving, and shepherding to the Lassie jobs of assisting first responders. Usually, a handler is nearby, guiding the dog with yelps, whistles, or other sorts of commands. Now, researchers at Auburn University in Alabama have been working on a system that dispenses with the need for a handler to be nearby. Joining us now is researcher Jeff Miller, who designed the device and the system that it uses. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Can you describe the challenges in creating a system to basically create a remote control dog?
Well, as you said, the Canine Detection and Research Institute at Auburn had they trained canines to be able to detect explosives or drugs, that sort of thing. And so the Office of Naval Research got in the mix and said, well, would it be possible to do all this remotely? That was really kind of the first step, try to figure out if you could send, for example, Labrador Retriever without the handler being there, just using tones and vibrations. That was really kind of the first part of this project, and so we actually were able to use a Wii remote to be able to do this, to send a dog way off into the distance using tones and vibrations. Canines respond really well to tones. The next stage, though, of this project was to, well, what if you can't see the dog anymore? Let's say the dog's gone way off behind some building or over a hill or something. How can you still control this dog from way off in the distance? Well, in order to do that, we needed to move to what's called autonomous control. That is where we could basically put in GPS coordinates into a system that would then control control the dog for us, where we don't even have to use any hands. We basically just put in the GPS coordinates, and the system will get the dog there. So the difficulties in that are you're having to hook onto this dog various kinds of devices, and the dog is running. And those sensors and so forth are getting jostled around, and yet we still have to be able to accurately figure out where's this dog at and where's he at compared to where we want him to be. And so there was definitely a lot of issues that went into trying to make this happen. But ultimately, we were able to use a system that would make this happen, where we could actually get a dog to waypoints that are way off in the distance.
I was thinking that you'd have to start with an extremely well-trained dog, but then I was also thinking, do you want to train a dog fresh with a system like this, or is it something that a well-trained dog can pick up and add to its toolbox, I suppose?
Well, this particular canine that we were using, he had been trained in other sorts of things, including the detection commands and so forth, but he was then trained in addition to what he already was able to do. He was trained to be able to respond to tones and vibrations. That was in addition to what he had. Now this canine is a particularly smart canine compared to maybe some others. I mean, it's really got to be, my understanding is, a certain kind of dog that has the ability to even do this. But this was kind of an additional package to his the training he already had. I think I asked at one, towards the end of the project, I asked the guy over the vet school. I said, "Hey, you know, when you retire this dog, I'd kind of be interested in having this dog." And he said, "Well, you need to have probably about $30,000
yeah.
to build." Yeah, so
wow.
This dog was very valuable with all the things he had been trained to be able to do.
The purpose to train them to operate autonomously is what? Is it an efficiency issue for the Navy? Is it a safety issue? Does it mean, is the dog more effective if it can just run off by itself, say, in a search and rescue, and not have to be having a handler hanging on to him or lagging behind?
Right. Well, there's several different scenarios that it would be of use. One of them is like the search and rescue scenario. Let's say a human can't necessarily get into crevices and so forth that a canine can, or even in detecting drugs or something like that. So a canine is able to move over terrains more efficiently than a human can. So if you can get the human out of the way and give the dog some freedom to do what it can naturally do, then that can actually be better than actually having a handler there, which kind of could slow him down and make him more cumbersome to the dog, really.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about autonomous control of canines with one of the researchers that has been working on this at Auburn University at the Canine Detection and Research Institute at Auburn University, Jeffrey Miller. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does the control system look like on the dog? Is it like a saddlebag or something?
Well, it looks kind of like a vest, and on top of it, we've got a GPS receiver, and then there's a pretty small box that has all of our sensors in it, including an IMU system with accelerometers, gyroscopes, magnetometers, and there's a radio that can communicate with the home base station where we are. So, you know, it's pretty light. That was one of the difficult things about this this whole project, was trying to figure out a way to get what we needed on the dog and it still be very compact and not weigh that much, because you don't want to, you know, there's only so much you can put on a dog before it's just really not going to be conducive to the dog being able to work effectively. And so that was one of the difficulties in this, was making that happen. Ultimately, we were able to do that, but that also... The more compact you make it, the more difficult it makes it to be able to track the dog as effectively, because you can't use as nice as sensors, that sort of thing. So in order to keep it low cost and small, that does tie our hands a little bit in being able to do this effectively.
What's the user interface like for the human handlers? What does it look like from their end?
Well, with the remote control option, you know, I mentioned that it was actually a Wii remote, you know, the Wii game system, which we thought was pretty interesting.
But is it like a joystick or something?
Right. It was actually a joystick you could use, and we thought that was pretty funny. But with the autonomous control side of it, you basically the point we were at in the system whenever I finished my work there at Auburn was ultimately we had a program where you could just plug in GPS coordinates, and it would just send it to the canine, and then we could just push go, and it would go.
Would it do this by, say, a vibration or a tone that has the dog make a left or a right?
Right. We would give a we had a tone that would tell the dog to go forward.
Okay.
And you had a different tone that would tell him to stop. And there was a left and right vibration command, and then there was a recall command. So that was what all the canine was working with. Another one of the difficulties of this is when the dog is his heart's beating and so forth, he responds better to the tones than he does to vibration. So really, all of the system would have actually, it's a perfect system except for the fact that sometimes the canine just simply wouldn't feel the vibrations. So we actually have already considered another stage of the project, which will actually improve that. But even with the vibrations in place, we still had an amazing degree of accuracy in this system.
Unmanned robots and drones are becoming more and more prevalent. You know, we hear about them all the time. What's the advantage of a dog instead of building a robot for these sorts of tasks? I mean, I know my dog has a nose the size of an apple, so she's a good smeller.
Well, I'll tell you, we cannot mimic at this point. In our understanding of engineering, we have not been able to mimic what a canine can do, especially with regard to its odor detection abilities.
Hmm.
And on top of that, to make a robot that could do what a canine can do naturally, we're just way away from being able to do that. And so it makes sense, if you can, to try to harness this ability, this natural ability that a canine has. And so that's what we're doing. You know, forget trying to build a robot. That would take a lot of, you know, a lot more research. You'd probably put this off into the future, this mm-hmm. ability, by decades. Yeah.
It makes me wonder if when they do start working on that, how much it'll be like a dog.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, it would make sense for them really to develop a robot that would mimic exactly what a canine can do, because he can do it effectively.
How do you measure the success of the system? How did you test it, and when did you, know that there was success?
Well, we would we had two different types of environments, trying to anticipate the sorts of scenarios the canine would be placed in. We had a type of environment where it was basically just an open field, and we would have waypoints out there, various cones, or in this case, the canine, the way that it was trained, he would. His goal was to try to find this little toy that they call a bumper. So we would have multiple bumpers throughout the field. Some of them are decoys, and some of them are the actual one that we want them to find. And we would command the dog to go to certain waypoints along the way, and so he had to obey the commands instead of just going with what he wanted to do, and that is just grab the first bumper that he saw.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could get him to that final destination, then it was considered a success. Now, the other type of environment was more of like an urban type environment where there were paths, kind of like streets or sidewalks, and so the canine would move up to an intersection and have to know, after we stopped him, he'd have to know whether to turn left, right, or go forward, depending upon the commands that we gave him. So if the canine was not able to do that, we would give him, you know, if he moved up, say, to the first intersection and immediately turned the wrong way whenever we gave him a command, then it was going to be a fail. Well, it wasn't immediately. We would give him, there's a course correction option that would make it where if he turned the wrong way, we would still try to maneuver him back the other way. But then if he didn't pull it off on the second try, then we would actually have to give him a recall and it'd be a fail. So there you go. That's kind of how it works.
Some researchers are working to control certain animals by implanting electrodes. Is that something you considered in this process?
No, that's not something that we're particularly looking at, because the vet school at Auburn is, you know, they're already training these canines to be able to do certain things. So we're essentially kind of piggybacking on their research. But yeah, there is some crazy research being going on that's going on in other places. And I think it's Japan that's doing cockroaches, actually implanting electrodes into the brains of cockroaches, which, you know, a little bit creepy considering cockroaches, you know, can survive most things, and they're pretty sneaky and can get in places with little cameras or something that we might not want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing no electrode implantation in this particular project.
Have there been any cameras attached to the gear in your case, so you can see what the dog is seeing?
Yeah, we actually, in the vest system that was designed, there was the option of having cameras attached, but in this phase of our project, we're not needing to use that. But that would be something more long-term where we would probably want to use that.
Now, do you see this as a prospect for your average pet owner? I joked about it at the beginning, you know, wouldn't you love it if your dog could go take itself for a walk? But is that a prospect for most people or not? It sounds like the dog needs to be highly trained.
Well, it would have to be highly trained, and you could have organizations that could do that and train the canines to be able to do it. I believe long term, that is something that, in fact, I think it'd be more effective use of the canine would be for a seeing eye type situation where, let's say, a person wants to go to McDonald's and all he'd have to do is, you know, through Braille or whatever, push the right button and there would already be pre-programmed paths for the canine, and he could just, you know, the canine could just walk the blind person along that predefined path without the blind person even, you know, having to know what's going on or anything. The canine would just already be trained to do that. I think that there is a place for that in the future where this system could be used for that.
And sort of related to the robotics issue, it might make some people uncomfortable, but could this type of research eventually lead to, like, cyborg-type dogs?
Well, this is in a form of cyborg kind of work as it is, because it's essentially, you know, taking a biological system and using coupling that with a robotic type system. So in that way, it's a bio robot or a cyborg. But that's not that. You probably look more at brain electrode implantation is more the classical picture you have in your mind of what that would be. Which, you know, that goes back to, for example, a man in the 50s that was doing that with bulls, and where he could stand out there in front of a bull that was charging him and push a button, and it would stop the bull in his tracks. So, you know, you might think of that more as a cyborg. This is more of but this technically would still be considered a biorobot. It's just not invasive.
Okay. It doesn't become part of their anatomy.
Right, right.
Well, Jeffrey Miller, thanks for joining us today. A lot of food for thought about my dog when I return tonight. She's actually a real good girl. Thanks for joining us today.
Yes, ma'am.
Jeffrey Miller, he's a researcher in mechanical engineering at the Canine Detection and Research Institute at Auburn University. Coming up, Russell Holley, tech blogger for geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Apple is set to hold one of its big media events in just a few minutes. What can we expect? Well, Russell Holley, a tech blogger for geek.com, has already informed me that as soon as we're done with this segment, he is going to be hanging up and going to the event, I'm sure virtually. So thanks for joining us, Russell, and squeezing us in.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. It's fun to be able to talk about it.
So we talked about it a little bit, but let's just, you know, of what people were thinking. Do you know more now?
So there's certainly been a lot more information that's come kind of out of every which direction. Apple has not been great at keeping secrets recently. A lot of their part suppliers in China, you know, details about how the hardware is going to work keep slipping out from a couple different places over there. So it's really looking like what we're going to see today is two different phones from Apple, which is, you know, kind of a new and an unheard of thing from them. Usually they have one phone each year, and you know, it has either the major version number, you know, the 3, the 4, the 5, or it will have, you know, the S attachment to the end. And so this is what they call an S year, where instead of, you know, seeing an iPhone 6, we will see an iPhone 5S. Which is expected to look similar as far as hardware goes, you know, have the camera in the same place and the microphone in the same place and all that stuff, but will have very different internals, most likely a improved camera, faster processor, a new kind of storage that'll allow for faster storage and greater performance when it comes to loading applications,
mm-hmm.
and possibly a fingerprint sensor.
Which would work how?
Well, the idea from what we've seen so far is that there's going to be a ring around where the home button is on your iPhone,
mm-hmm.
and when you press your thumb there, it will use that as an ID system to either unlock the phone or perform other secure actions.
That's kind of cool, isn't it?
I think that's very cool, and it's also not new. It's never worked particularly well in the past when other phone companies have tried it, but Apple, you know, has a tendency to take things that haven't worked particularly well and putting a pretty original spin on them. So it'll be really interesting to see how they made that work and how secure it ends up actually being.
And they kind of have to, because I'm still okay with my iPhone. They have to do something to to make it special against Siri is whatever Siri was, and that was the big thing a couple years ago, right? So,
yeah, Siri was a big thing. And the interesting thing about Siri was that it wasn't a new thing from Apple. It was something that Apple bought and just integrated into their entire setup. Siri was actually already an app for the iPhone well before it became a system feature. But there has been a lot of people wondering, you know, what new thing Apple is going to do that'll, you know, really kind of make people look and say, oh, I really need that,
mm-hmm.
Instead of keeping the phone that they have now. And maybe it seems like the direction that they might be heading isn't so much, you know, this is, you know, absolutely must have, you know, throw your phone away and get a new phone features, but releasing a second set of hardware for people who would rather, you know, spend a little bit less and still get most of the features, if not all of them.
Yeah, right. There's you said two phones, and mm-hmm. the price point's a big difference between them.
Yeah, so it's expected that, you know, when you go to walk into the store, you know, most of the time, unless there's like a special or something like that, you get the new iPhone is, you know, $199 on contract, or $599 without. And so the idea behind the iPhone 5C, which is supposedly going to stand for color, because there's going to be many, many different colors, kind of like the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
They will have this kind of cheaper, you know, plastic version of the phone that will be less expensive. And in order to make it work, it would really have to be, you know, $100 or $200 less expensive when you go to purchase it in the store in order to create that kind of separator from one device to another. So it'll be interesting to see how exactly Apple brands that and explains how that's going to work today.
Now, the shape is supposed to change slightly with the cheaper version, not just the color.
So because they're using the plastic casing, it's expected to be a little tiny bit thicker to facilitate this plastic casing. But in general, it should be imperceptible. You know, when you have them side by side, you probably aren't going to notice. You'll probably just look at it and see. It'll probably look like an iPhone that's in a case.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably what you'll see here is, you know, you'll have the two iPhones and they'll look physically similar when you're looking straight at them, but then you go to turn them and that's when you'll see the big difference between the two, because one will have, you know, that very metallic surface to it that we've seen from the iPhone 5, and then the other will have this plastic surface in several very bright, flashy colors.
You said speedier, better storage, new storage for loading. Is speedier a big issue for a lot of iPhone users?
it doesn't end up being a lot of issue, a big issue for a lot of iPhone buyers when you first get the phone. But like anything, it slows down over time. And mm-hmm. you know, especially when you are an active user that has a ton of applications or you know, you store a bunch of media. So the idea of a faster processor just means, you know, greater access for developers to you know, create more tools. It'll also mean, depending on the architecture for the processor, better battery life, which is obviously something everybody would be a fan of.
Yes. yes, absolutely. All right. So then there's other couple other things. New iPads are on the menu. There might be a new iPad 5.
No, we haven't seen iPads this year yet, and you know, in order to get them out for the holiday season, it would make sense for Apple to release some iPads. Last year, Apple kind of surprised everyone with the iPad Mini, the 8-inch iPad as opposed to the 10-inch iPad, and it looks like the next generation of iPads will all have that same basic shape as the iPad Mini, where it's very thin bezels on the side with a kind of chunkier bezel on the top and bottom. That'll, you know, make it so that the screen itself is, you know, special so that you can grab it on the side without, you know, touching whatever you're doing in the application. But not a whole lot in the way of, you know, different resolutions or anything like that. It's still expected that the iPad Mini will be a lower resolution display, but a less expensive product overall, whereas the 10-inch iPad will continue to have that Retina display. And be kind of the flagship iPad.
You know, you mentioned a new camera, and I just feel like we need to have a separate program just on cameras. I'm getting lost in, as far as, you know, a lot of people said, yeah, I took a picture of something the other day. Well, I actually wasn't using my camera. I was using my phone. It's their cameras, and then we, you know, incidentally use them as phones. Even actually, the most rare thing I do on my iPhone is talk on it. So what about the camera? How much better will it get?
Well, so an interesting thing from the iPhone 5 is it was the first of the iPhone cameras to have a glass cover, to not have a glass cover over the front. It was this this sapphire crystal cover to make sure that it didn't get scratched and to you know, keep it as clear as possible. And that was an important new thing, you know, because it's one of the most damaged components on an iPhone is the glass, not even so much the camera, just the glass right in front of it.
Right.
And so that was a big thing. But I think what they're going for this time is, you know, more impressive internals. So maybe a higher megapixel count or a larger sensor, the ability to take, you know, greater photos and then, you know, edit them in some way. But you're absolutely right. You know, smartphone cameras, especially over the last year, when you look at phones like the HTC One and the Moto X, the camera technology itself, you know, really takes its own kind of language.
Yeah, it's kind of what people buy it for. I mean, how much can they improve the talking experience? When do you think they're ever going to change the name of these devices?
You know, I think that they're you know, that they're going to keep that in line because that's how, you know, Apple has done it with all of their products. You look at the MacBook line, and you look at their, you know, their Mac Pro line. These are you know, unfortunately, when you do what I do for a living, especially with MacBooks, it becomes really confusing to distinguish them, you know, from one another, because it becomes the spring 2012 MacBook Retina, you know, it becomes the full title for these products. And so Apple's, you know, they did something a little different with the iPhone, and that they started giving them version numbers instead of just calling them, you know, iPhone and then having it be, you know, well, the spring 2012 iPhone, you know, but it's the only one of their products to do that. Even last year, the iPad didn't get, you know, iPad 4 as its designator. It was just called the iPad.
Mm-hmm.
So the iPhone is, you know, unique in that you can tell them apart easily by giving them numbers.
Which eventually are going to confuse me like everything else does. All right, so let's switch. I know that's just minutes away. You're going to be in on that, and we can talk about, you know, get your impressions next week from what you hear. But for music fans, there are no shortage of ways to pipe the tunes to your earbuds whether it's downloading MP3s, storing them in the cloud, or streaming songs on services like Pandora or Spotify. One drawback, though, is that you can't always get the music you want on all the different devices you use. We've talked about it before. Microsoft is hoping to solve that and make some headway into the digital music market with a new service. Tell us about it. What are they going to call it?
Well, so they've taken their Xbox Music service, which has been, you know, kind of Xbox exclusive for a while, where you could go and purchase music and listen to it on your Xbox. And this seems kind of silly from an outside perspective, but it was a big deal, especially when the first Xbox came out, because it was the first of the major gaming consoles that included a separate ability for you to load music and play it while you were playing games. So you were playing games and you had the game stuff, but instead of the game music, you had the music that you had loaded playing through the speakers. And so Xbox kind of led the way with that. But then, you know, when it came to producing digital music, it became really hard to compete with Apple and Google and Amazon for actually selling this music, much less making it available everywhere. So what they did here with Xbox Music was they made it so that you have the same playlists and the same radio stations and the same feature set on the Xbox 360 and then the Xbox One when it comes out, but also on all Android devices, all iOS devices, all Windows Phone devices. And it's free to use in the browser as well. So even if you're not an Xbox user or, you know, you're tied into Google Music or into iTunes, you can check it out for free on the browser. And it's really the first of the music services to, you know, go kind of game system first and then everywhere else. It's hard enough to get iTunes to work on anything that's not an iPod anyway. So it's interesting to see Microsoft take this step forward.
All right. So how much does it's a subscription? How much does it cost?
It varies based on usage and activity. It's $7.99 a month for kind of the most generic of the services, where it gives you kind of the unlimited playback and the ability to see stuff everywhere else. But then they said that by the end of the year, they're going to be working on kind of family subscription models to tie in with the Xbox and a few other price points, maybe.
Do you need to be tied to the internet to use it? Connected, I should say?
So you would need to if you're accessing, you know, kind of the radio stations or to download new music.
Uh-huh.
But like most services, you can, you know, kind of pin certain amounts of music to whatever device that you're using.
Okay, we just have a few more minutes left. You wanted to talk about some Sony announcements for gamers, the PS Vita?
Yeah, so the PS Vita has been Sony's kind of weird handheld gaming console to try and compete with Nintendo for a little while. And it's you know, it's been moderately successful, but never been completely successful. And one of the things that Sony's doing here in time for the holidays is releasing something called Vita TV, which is this really tiny, you know, it fits in the palm of your hand, little white slab that plugs into your television. And with a PlayStation controller, it gives you the ability to play your PS Vita games on your television. And you don't need to own a PlayStation Vita in order to gain access to those things. On top of that, it also gives you access to Netflix and Hulu Plus and all of those digital video services that are also available on the PlayStation Vita. So it's a fun, kind of plug-in box that gives you the Netflix stuff that pretty much everything gives you now, but then also gives you this kind of gaming layer for people who want to play those games on a television.
Is this like, what is it called, Roku or Apple TV?
So Roku and Apple TV offer, like I said, the streaming services, for all of their platforms, but there's not really much in the way of gaming on any of those.
Okay.
And so there's different versions, you know, there's with Apple TV, you can stream stuff from an Apple product to an Apple TV, and play on, you know, your iPhone or your iPad. But this allows you to pick up an actual game controller and play the PlayStation Vita games on the television.
And it can be used with, everybody hang on to your seats, the DualShock 3 game controller. How big of a deal is that?
Sony's always had a fun name for their controllers. That dual vibration motor was something that they worked hard to own. So
is that a big deal that it can be used with that, or?
Well, so the PlayStation controller is really kind of iconic for you know, gamers.
Yeah.
And, you know, using that touch interface, you know, on an iPod or on a tablet is really not great for a lot of games.
Uh-huh.
So it is kind of a big deal that you can pick up a controller that a lot of people already have in their house anyway, and play on your television.
And what games, we're running out of time, but I wonder, what games does PS Vita TV give you access to? All of them or what?
So PS Vita TV will give you access to the entire indie library that was announced earlier this year. And they're going to have a full lineup announced later, but it's not every PS Vita game, because a lot of the PS Vita games rely on touch interfaces, because there's a touch component to the PS Vita, and they haven't explained exactly how that's going to work yet. But it's a $100 plug-in TV system, which is kind of roughly priced in the same area as Apple TV and. Mm-hmm. And Roku. So it's definitely a great add-on.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, I'm going to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us today. And we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Russell Holly is a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. And streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.